Good evening and welcome to Radio EduTalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay as ever, and this evening I'm delighted to welcome to the show Dr. Jonathan Delafield Butt, who's going to be talking with us over the next half an hour or so on the role of movement in early social and emotional development and implications for autism. So welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Could you just start off by telling us a little bit, or the audience a little bit, about who you are and what you do?
Okay. I'm in the School of Education at the University of Strathclyde as a senior lecturer. So my my job role really is research and teaching. So my research, which is really the passion, you know, a lot of the passion and drive behind learning more about children, has a somewhat unusual career path, I suppose. I started off as a chemist a very long time ago, as an undergraduate student, and I was very interested in the hard sciences and getting a firm grasp on reality, as it were, through the scientific method. But I was also very interested in the mind and experience, and especially within experience, I was fascinated by feelings. So I wanted to learn more about them, but with a chemistry degree, it was somewhat difficult. I was in the States, in fact. I began my degree in the States where you could double major. So I was majoring in psychology and chemistry at the same time. But I finished my undergraduate studies in England, and it wasn't possible to do that. So when I graduated with a degree in medicinal chemistry, I did a master's degree in neuroscience at Edinburgh University, which at the time was one of the only three institutions in the UK that did neuroscience. So I used the neuroscience really as a transition to move from chemistry into studying the mind, into psychology, because of course the brain, the brain itself is largely a complex organization of chemical messengers moving from neuron to neuron, and also within the neurons themselves. I mean, it's complex macrochemistry that makes up the cellular structures and the macrocellular structures and so forth. So chemistry really underpins the workings of the brain. And of course, in our understanding of the mind, the brain underpins the workings of the mind. So this all fit together very nicely. And I was delighted to win a PhD studentship to continue that work and looking at brain development and especially the genetics and the molecular biology of brain development. So, you know, genetics and molecular biology is something of a strength in Scotland and in Edinburgh in particular. So the lab I was working in was very good, and we did some excellent work on trying to unravel the genetic networks and therefore the molecular networks that underpinned brain development in the embryo. So how do you form those basic structures of the brain from what really is, to begin with, a totally uniform sphere, like a golf ball. There's no differentiation. It's, for all intents and purposes, the same no matter which side you look at. Inside, it's there's complexity, you know, quite extreme complexity, but it hasn't unraveled yet. It hasn't come to form, differentiate, and form the axes of the body and divide into cells with specialized cell function to give rise to what becomes later brain, eyes, tongue, nose, limbs, fingers, digits, liver, you know, heart, and so on. You know, that hasn't happened yet, but it does, and it happens over the next, you know, in the human, the next 8 weeks from the fertilized ovum to the fully formed embryo is about 8 weeks of cell division, molecular cascades, and complex unfolding of a beautiful organism. A bit like what we see a flower doing, you know, for example, or the chrysalis of a butterfly. So that was fascinating, you know, and that was a foundation for understanding, well, okay, this is the physical substrate. This is the physical element or the physical side of a mental experience, you know. So it's getting at that mental experience, which I wanted to probe further. And that, of course, really is in psychology. So after the PhD, I jumped over into psychology, also at Edinburgh. And Edinburgh is actually a very great university for many reasons, but one reason is the proximity of the different subjects around George Square. around the sort of center of the university, as I like to think of it. So next to biomedical science in the medical school, where a lot of the genetics and molecular biology work is done, you have the school. You have the psychology department, which is studying babies and children. And of course, that's the logical extension from embryogenesis through fetal development into infancy and into childhood. Well, really, we can, you know, psychology has a very firm grasp of what that mind is and how that mind develops in terms of its understanding of the world and its engagement with it. So I jumped over into psychology and then started studying infant development. And that led, just to cut a long story short, that led into pragmatic and applied work in education, where, in fact, all of that knowledge that's been developed in psychology and neuroscience and a little bit of philosophy of mind, all of that understanding can have real-world impact and immediate effect in the quality of teaching and the methods and understanding that underpins professional teaching practice and also children's nature as learning animals, you know, animals that are eager and very quick at learning. So I can get to the movement part, but maybe you want to insert a question. I realize I've been going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's brilliant, Jonathan. I'm really looking forward to the next wee while listening to your work on tonight's topic, the role of movement in early social and emotional development and implications for autism. What I will say is that many of our listeners will access the podcast sometime after this evening, but if any listeners are listening to the live stream, then feel free to get in touch with Jonathan with any comments or questions. You can get in touch in either of the two usual ways. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, or you can pop something up on Twitter with the hashtag edutalk. Now, Jonathan, just before you start to talk about the movement in early years, and I believe even movement pre-birth, you've got some questions for listeners that they might help them with their own reflection over the duration of tonight's show. First of all, you ask, what does it mean to express yourself? How do you get what you want? How do you discover how something works? And you're also asking, how do you know what your friend wants? So on you go, Jonathan.
Yeah, okay, that's a very good transition into the psychology, because movement, of course, is not something that we typically think of as being very psychological. You know, when we think of psychology and even the psychologists within psychology, we probably agree that most of the focus is on thoughts, you know, how we think and how we manipulate thoughts and how we learn number lines and what numbers mean and how they relate to each other in complex codes such as mathematics. You know, psychology is also very interested in how we perceive things, because that's a very mental phenomenon. You know, how we perceive color or form or contours, how we distinguish foreground from background, and so on. So these are typically the kinds of things that more readily spring to mind when one thinks about what the mind does and what the mind is. But that's the key. I just stumbled on it. What the mind does is of utmost importance, because the only way that the mind can do things is through movement. And the only way the mind can also learn or understand about the world is through movement. So I'm just sort of putting the answers there on a plate for at least the first question or the first couple of questions. You know, how do we express ourselves? So our thoughts, our intentions, our desires, how do we express those? And the only way that we can express those is through movement. So movement is fundamental. It's fundamental to what the mind is and what the mind, certainly what the mind does. So Sperry, who's a famous neurologist, in fact, the Nobel Prize-winning neurologist from Caltech, did a lot of the split brain work in the mid-1900s. So he makes a point that all the product of the mind is in movement itself. Well, everything has to come out. All those thoughts have to come out through movement. So it's something to do with the way that we structure movement and pattern movement. That enables us to do complex tasks and perform complex logical operations in the world. And a very important psychologist, Jimmy Gibson, from Cornell University in the States, he made the point, again, about the same time as Sperry, that we also perceive through movement. So we're also perceiving the environment. We're understanding what it's composed of through movement. Even when we're still and we don't appear to be moving, we're still moving. Our eyes are making small saccades. Our olfactory system is very active. It's actively sensing the environment and the chemicals in the air. Our eyes are active agents. They're active components. We're perceiving actively. We're not perceiving passively. So this is Gibson introduces quite a radical shift into psychology, which is still actually taking some time to fully absorb, that the mind is actively generating these kinds of perceptions and these kinds of understandings about the world through movement. And it does so by generating perception, which is contingent on the movement. So if it makes sense, we can go back, and in fact, there's a philosopher, Alvin Noe, he's from Berkeley in the States and Harvard as well. He had a very nice book in about 2004 where he picked up on some points from Aristotle. Aristotle saw vision as a active phenomenon, not a passive thing. So this is the thing, that vision is active. Our eye saccades are scanning the environment actively. We're on a biochemical sense, we're actively charging the complex chemical molecules that receive the photons and respond accordingly. It's an active process. So Aristotle likened vision to a blind man feeling his way through the environment with a walking stick or with a stick, using it to touch the environment to get a sense of where things were in relation to other things and to his own body movement. So if you can imagine walking into a room blindfolded or blinded with a stick, you can use that stick to touch the furniture, to touch the floor, to touch the ceiling, and then you're sensing the responses of the stick as it moves from the curtain to the table to the wall and so on. And it actively picks up information, therefore, about the world. And the eyes do this very quickly. They scan that environment very quickly. They touch the environment like the man with the stick and quickly pick up the information and then assemble it in what psychology likes to refer to as representations. So you build up this quick visual representation of the world, but you're doing that actively. And this is the point. So this kind of introduces us to, well, movement is tightly coupled to perception. And then it's a question of, well, okay, so then how do we structure that movement to understand and to perceive the world? And one way that we do that is through controlling what we think it's going to achieve. So we need to set out to learn what these movements achieve. And then we can pattern our movements to allow ourselves to achieve the kinds of things that we want to achieve. So this is the idea that our movement is prospective. It's reaching out into the future, and it's anticipating the kinds of things that future is going to deliver based on the kind of movement that we've just generated to acquire it. Does that make sense? Am I getting a little bit too philosophical or too complex?
No, I think I'm keeping up, Jonathan. Yeah, on you go.
Okay, so if I want to touch the table, I'll make a movement with my stick, for example, to touch the table. So I anticipate that if I make a certain kind of movement, that table is going to be touched and it's going to generate a certain kind of response, a knock, or if it's a table with velvet on top, it's going to be quite a soft brush. So when I set out to move, I anticipate what's going to happen. So I'm already structuring my movement from the beginning to achieve the kind of effect that I think it's going to create. So this is what I mean by the mind being generative. It's creating the kind of future that we want. So our wants or our desires, our intentionality is a part of the mechanism of the way that we are moving and perceiving. So this is actually quite important because it's the piece of logic or the mechanism that puts agency in the moving and perceiving person from the very beginning. And from the work that we've been doing, we're showing that actually that prospective agency, that anticipatory nature of moving is there in the child from the very beginning of his or her life. Certainly there from infancy, from a newborn, from the very first moments of infancy, and our work at Edinburgh has shown that, and also work by other colleagues as well in other departments. And the more recent work is reflecting back then on the fetal movement, looking at the way that the fetus moves. We can see that the fetus is moving also with this prospective anticipation. It's this prospective control of movement, anticipating the kinds of responses that the environment is going to give from as early as 14 weeks gestation, and perhaps a touch earlier, but not much. So from about the 14th week of gestation, which, some of you will be aware, is very young. You know, this is just the beginning of the second trimester. So embryogenesis ends at about 8 weeks. So that's when the embryo is fully formed. At about that age, the embryo is only about 2 centimeters long from head to tail, you know, head to bottom, basically. So that's a very small embryo. And then another 6 weeks later, the skeletomuscular system and the nervous innervation is mature enough and developed enough to be able to form controlled, purposeful movement, or at least movement with prospectivity, with an anticipation of what is to come. So that's the very beginning. You know, this is very interesting. This is the very beginning of what I think we can reasonably say is the conscious mind, the aware mind, the mind that is that knows ahead of time what's going to come, and is able to generate that kind of sensory world. Right? So this is a generating mind of the very young fetus. And that develops, of course, 14, 16, 18, 22, 24 weeks, all the way up until childbirth. But the very young age, the very young fetal age at about 14, 16, 18 weeks is really interesting because the fetus is so small, it's got lots of room to kick about and move in utero. So it can perform quite complex tasks like bicycling the legs, you know, turning the body around, turning over. It can reach out to touch the umbilical cord, and often these small fetuses will grab the umbilical cord like you might do a rope. The fetus will explore through touch his or her body, you know. There's a very nice, so Alessandra Piontelli from Milan, she's done some very good work on this, and she's produced some volumes or some monographs more recently that detail the unfolding of these complex movements. And the fetus will move his or her hand to touch the face, and especially the highly innervated regions like the lips, but the innervated being the parts of the face that have sensation, that have been innervated by the nervous, by the neurons that are coming from brainstem. So that's the bit of sensing. So the fingertips are already sensuous, they're already innervated, so they can feel what's coming from the fingertips. But then they can feel also when they touch their lips, they can feel what that is feeling like on the lips, as well as simultaneously what the fingers are feeling. So they're getting this contingency. Oh, I touch that, and I get a sensation in the lips. That, you know, what is becoming to be formed, but the idea of lips, or knowledge about what lips means, with the fingertips. So, in fact, this nervous innervation grows, and it grows across the scalp, and innervates the forehead over the weeks of gestation. And the infants or the fetus will follow that innervation, and they'll test what it's like to feel the side that's innervated, so that the side that's getting sensation on the scalp, to just a little bit, you know, closer to the nose, towards the forehead that's not innervated yet, where in fact when you touch it, it's like touching something inanimate, like some wood, because it's not innervated with sensory fibers. So they're not getting that response on the head, but they're still getting the response in the fingertips. So that's quite, you know, unique. And the fetus will explore that. So this is really interesting evidence that that the fetus at these young ages in gestation are sentient and knowledgeable and conscious enough to be able to recognize these differences, and also exploratory enough to be able to play with that difference, to explore the different sensations that the fetus is generating. So this goes back to Piaget. You know, I mean, Piaget said this about babies, that the first thing the babies explore is their motor system, what their body does when they move it. You know, and this idea that infants, children, human organisms generally are playful and exploratory, and they have their own sense of agency, that they did that. You know, that they did this, created this sensation, created this feeling, created this future. This is the basis of forming knowledge, and therefore forming understanding about what the world is and what the world can, what their relationship to the world is. So this is very, very important, and it's very interesting to see that at such an early age. You know, it's a little bit unexpected, because you might not, you know, we typically think of the fetus as being, you know, rather simple and unconscious and just a bundle of reflexes, no mental capacities. But if you think about it and you start to look at the logic, you know, the reasoning dictates that actually this is conscious in the sense of having knowledge about something, you know, or getting to know something. So con with, and psi, the root psi, SCI, being knowledge, and ness of the ofness. So it's the with knowingness. It's the with knowingness. That's what consciousness is with knowingness. And the fetus is generating that. It's generating that knowingness through its exploratory movement, which is giving it an understanding about what the world is, again, based on movement and the perceptual responses. So this is important for understanding child psychological development, and therefore how things might be going well. And what we might want to encourage, because this goes back to fundamental principles of psychology. You know, what is that psychological agent, that learning agent, and what is it? How is that agent structured? And therefore, what's important in terms of educational pedagogy, for example? What do we need to recognize and nurture and support or encourage? And you know, fundamentally, agency is one of them. And, you know, Scotland, of course, is a great place to be right now because of the Curriculum for Excellence and the recognition of child-centered practice in many guises, because we need to nurture that sense of agency, because that agency is what generates the learning. And everybody knows this now. It's nice to see it, you know, really enshrined in the legislation and in the educational policy. But that's happening from pre-birth, you know. So this is happening very, very early. And it becomes important then for understanding, well, how might development, you know, be going wrong or going differently in some cases of pathology. So we traced autism and the genesis of autism back to its roots in movement. And this is a kind of moving on to another chapter of the story, moving on to autism. I'm just wondering maybe if you have any questions about the movement side and the learning side and the agency side of what I've been talking about.
I think at this point, Jonathan, yeah, it would be great to link it to autism. And am I right in saying that, you know, you would argue, or you would show the evidence that the autism then, or the first signs would actually be pre-birth?
That's right. And that's a kind of difficult question to answer, because it's challenge, uh-huh. I think, to be able to identify it pre-birth. It's already a challenge to be able to identify autism at, you know, 1 year old, or even 2 years old, or even 2.5 or 3 years old. So, you know, we have a long way to go before we're there yet. But theoretically, yes, that ought to be possible. You know, but it's a slightly more complex story than that, because the movement is. So, if I can just tell the autism story. We think. So this is work with Colwyn Trebarthen, who takes the logical extension from what I've been talking about in terms of movement. So that movement work, most of it was done with David Lee, who's a professor emeritus now from Edinburgh University. And, you know, Colwyn Trebarthen, again, another professor emeritus from Edinburgh University, he understands that and incorporates into his thinking about older children that they form movements and they use movements to communicate And that's always with this anticipation, always with this expectation of what's to come. So I talked a lot about the fetus reaching out to touch the head or the placental wall or the umbilical cord. But of course, when that baby is born, the most important thing the baby reaches out and touches, and I'm thinking, you know, in a little bit metaphorically now, is his or her mother or father or caregiver. My child is jumping into the conversation.
Don't worry about it, Jonathan. Don't worry about it, Jonathan. It's, it happens to me several times.
So she's picked up on the baby idea, and she's having lots of fun with that. So the idea is that we communicate through movement, and we understand. We come to understand other people's minds also through movement. I mean, this is the crux, as it were, of Colin Trevorton's work, and it's obviously a lot more complex than that when we start to look at how those movements are able to communicate and so forth. But the basic notion is that we understand people's minds through movement, through the kinds of movements that they're making, and we're able to share our minds with other people through the way that we're moving. And other people can read our intentions through the way that we're moving, through the way that we're adjusting our body posture and even the kinematic form, so the speed and the velocity profile, as it were, of our movement, indicates what we're intending to do. And this is a form of implicit mind reading. So it's direct perception of another person's intentions, right, to use the kind of technical language. So we directly perceive what someone's intending to do, not by what they're saying or thinking about it rationally or reflecting on it, but we directly perceive that intention in their movement. And this is very important work coming out of especially Italy. Frisolati's group who discovered the mirror neuron system, and Galice and these people. I mean, this is really, really, really insightful, because what they show is that our brains respond to the intention's purpose in another person's movement. We're not rationalizing on it. So it's already there. Okay, so the autism story then is one now based on movement. So a lot of new evidence is coming out since 1999, when a very important paper by Teitelbaum was published in PNAS, that you could find motor differences, movement differences in babies that went on to develop autism from their home video. You know, so he did a retrospective analysis of home video of children, of babies that went on to develop autism and babies that went on to develop typically, and found, you know, significant differences in those that went on to develop autism. So this launched an entire field of study to try to measure those differences better and more robustly, because it was very difficult, in fact, to make those measurements at birth and be accurate and accurately predict whether or not that child was going to develop autism. But it was easier to do retrospectively. So this is the trick, is to be able to translate that into a tool that can be used for diagnosis or assessment. And that's not been achieved yet, I have to say. But what has been achieved is a lot more knowledge about the way that the movements are different. And the interesting thing for us is that at the same time, people have been doing lots and lots and lots of brain scanning of children with autism and adults with autism. And the one consistent difference in the autistic individuals' brains is a difference in the size of the brainstem. Now, we know that brainstem is the major center for organizing and coordinating movement. It works in conjunction with the hindbrain, with the cerebellum, to organize, structure, movement, but it does it in a way that's not a simple reflex responsive way, but it does it in an active generative way. Right, and this is the work from Jaak Pangset, the affective neuroscientist in Seattle. Now, he showed that, in all of his work, shows that conscious agency, again, going back to this idea of conscious agency, it's not a product of the cortex of rational reflective thought. It's actually a product of very ancient primitive brainstem systems. And together with Bjorn Merker, a neurologist from Uppsala in Sweden, and a very talented one at that, Bjorn Merker did a very sophisticated analysis of the kinds of, you know, components of the brain that are required for consciousness, and fell back to a theory that was developed in the 1950s by Penfield and Jasper, called the centroencephalic theory of consciousness. I mean, so Penfield and Jasper were neurologists, and they were doing cortical resections. They were removing huge, hemispheres of cortex, and taking another hemisphere offline as well during their operation. And what they found was that you could take away the cortex, and the patient could still be conscious. So it didn't make sense that the cortex should be responsible for consciousness, because they would remove it, and the patient would still be conscious. And this is this idea is supported by evidence from cat and rat experiments that neuroanatomists would do, rather gruesome ones at that, but nevertheless very insightful, where they would remove the cortex, again, through surgical technique, and the cat or the rat would be able to navigate tricky terrain. It would even be able to go through mating rituals, copulate, and wean litters, all without a cerebral cortex. So they only had the brainstem. So the cerebral cortex is the superficial stuff, the convoluted stuff that we typically think of as being brain. The brainstem is the extension of the spinal column at the top of the spine, and what we typically think of as being not brain. But actually, that brainstem is the brain. It's fundamentally brain, and it's generative, active, and it has knowledge, and it has access to all the perceptual organs, and it can coordinate and control and pattern movement to achieve the kinds of ends or desires in quotes that it sets out to achieve. So yeah, thanks that in line with Bjorn Merker and Marie van der Kukovic and a number of others. We now recognize this brainstem as being the so-called center of primary consciousness or primary self, right? And then this is overlayered in development with a secondary consciousness, which includes more the limbic system, the more anterior midbrain regions, together with limbic system moving into cortex. And then the tertiary self or tertiary consciousness, which is then cortical. So you go from this, ancient to modern modern man, as it were. But agency, generation of conscious understanding of the world and generative movements to engage in that purposely is fundamental, right? It's not something additional. And this is the point. So the question is, well, then, in terms of autism, if you have a small error, a small growth error, for example, growth errors are common in nature. They're there all the time in terms of genetic mutation, or not even genetic mutation, but simply disturbances in development. Or even in the case of the best circumstances, differences arise spontaneously. There's a small growth error, for example, in these very important central timing, motor timing and sensory timing and integration nuclei, of which the brainstem is a composition of such nuclei, then you're going to be thwarting, the efficient integration of sensory information and the efficient integration of the movements that are acquiring that sensory information. And the timing and integration is going to be off. So we're probing this. This is the hypothesis developed with Colwin, and actually it's become something. We're seeing it popping up in different locations as well, not quite in the same form that we have it, but the same basic idea that somehow movement is underpinning autism expression. I mean, we've tied it down to specific nuclei in the brainstem, and we want to probe those, because those nuclei are responsible not only for sensory and motor timing and integration, but they're also responsible for social engagement and regulation of heart rate, to some degree the fight or flight response, through what Poor has called the social engagement and polyvagal system. So we want to explore this because we think that there's a small, subtle timing and integration difference, which then means, in terms of development, that you need to have compensations in order to correct for those differences. And that's why children with autism and individuals with autism can develop quite sophisticated cognitive compensations, which become assets. They really become quite beneficial features. which are unique, and nevertheless can be highly beneficial. But at the same time, the autistic syndrome itself, the autistic symptoms themselves, can remain distressing, especially in childhood. So this is the sort of cusp of the theory at the moment. And the question, of course, is, okay, well, we're continuing to probe the theory. We want to see if we can discover these particular neurological differences that might exist in brainstem, which is not easy to do because brainstem is very hard to access, even with good brain scanners. We're collaborating with a group in Italy. Hopefully we'll get the funding to be able to use what's one of the best brain scanners in the world, and one of the best autism children's hospitals in the world as well, to be able to get that fine grain resolution imaging of the brainstem. So we'll see how that pans out. But in the meantime, we're also looking at how movement can be used in terms of therapy, because if autism is a disturbance of the movement system, and I think that's now largely accepted, then you ought to be able to alleviate it, facilitate rehabilitation, as it were, using the same principles of motor rehabilitation. So we're working with Professor Phil Rowe in biomedical engineering to look at that. He's a rehabilitation scientist, so that's his forte. And we're applying the same principles of neuromotor rehabilitation to autism. And in fact, there's a group of therapists who have a very well worked through and well thought through theoretically and practically approach to working with children with autism by addressing their movements and encouraging them to or enabling them really to be able to move efficiently and effectively. And once they can achieve efficient and effective movement, then their distress can be reduced and their anxiety reduced and their curiosity engaged. Because they can move successfully to engage with the world, and then the basis of learning is established. Now that you have a curious child who can do something in the world, and they're going to explore the possibilities of that by moving and grabbing things and putting them together and chucking them in the bin and doing all the kinds of things that young children do, infants and young children. So that's that motor development of learning, learning about the contingencies. If I take a block and put it with another block, it makes a crack. But if I stack it, it makes something quite different and elegant, and that's attractive. So this is the basis of learning. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense, or have I gone too far off into the neuroscience
there? Yeah, no, absolutely not, Jonathan. I've really enjoyed listening to you over the last wee while. I'm mesmerised by the work that's going on, and as a teacher of some 19 years, it just shows you that there's so much more to learn, particularly about certain pupils that we work with certain additional support needs. We're just coming into the last couple of minutes, Jonathan. I'm just going to ask a question that might be on the lips of some of our audience, many of whom will be practicing classroom teachers. You've talked a lot about the recent research and what's ongoing. In terms then of what might be arising in relation to therapies and new pedagogies, etc., where might teachers look at the moment to find out more about what's being tried out or what might be working in terms mm-hmm. of pupils on the with an autistic spectrum disorder?
Yeah, well, I think there's kind of two lessons here. I mean, one is the fundamental nature of movement in learning, and I've been speaking with my colleague David Kirk. He's the head of the School of Education, who recognizes that movement is the basis of learning, and has gathered a lot of evidence to show that there's a significant link between the motor capacities or the motor skills of young children and academic attainment. Because the two are linked, so there needs to be an increased recognition that movement underpins learning, and that has application throughout education, in many different guises, I have to say, because I mean it also relates to its feelings of capacity to succeed. It's a very public affair to move and to move purposely with other people, and to have capacity to be able to move. But I think there needs to be more targeted recognition that that movement is important and is not something that's ancillary or extra, but it's something that's fundamental and needs to be worked through both in the nursery school and in the primary school. But in terms of autism, I think there's the particular therapy. I mean, is called the Walden approach. I'm just trying to think where the best place to look at it. I mean, you can look at it on the internet. I'm just trying to now Google it. Just a second. The website is called autismandunderstanding.com. So it's autismandunderstanding.com, all one word. And it's actually a particular approach that's used in some schools in the Glasgow city area, and also in Oxfordshire and in Yorkshire. So it's used around, but it's not pervasive. But it's used by a number of skilled practitioners. So I think that's a resource to be able to look at what can be achieved through recognizing movement and through trying to work with movement. And again, it's the same principle as the motor skills in learning for typically developing children, that you need to be able to make those movements effectively and efficiently, because every time you move and you move successfully, that generates satisfaction. And it's that satisfaction that is the basis of confidence and feelings of security, and that one can do something with competence and generate the kinds of effects that one moves to generate. So it's that basic idea of moving to do something and to do something well, and assisting that capacity, whether the child has autism or is a typically developing kid or whatever, you know, just to enable that basic capacity for engaging the world, because that's fundamental to learning and therefore to our confidence and growth of knowledge, really.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us this evening on Radio EduTalk. We'd love to have you back on the show in the future to hear more about your work and research. And thank you for explaining it so succinctly and clearly. It's certainly I've enjoyed it, and I'm sure our listeners will have too. So thanks again, and best wishes for the future.